Thank you. Thank you all for coming this evening. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome Simon Sebag Montefiore and his monumental book, I have to say, The World, A Family History, which hopefully you all have.
I just have to take a picture.
This is the publicity shot.
It's a tradition. Amazing.
Have we got it?
Thank you.
And it really is a magisterial effort and tome. And one thing I like about it, I have to say, and we were talking about this earlier, is just how cosmopolitan and diverse it is. So it really does cover the entirety of the globe. And obviously for someone like myself who works on the Middle East and obviously the Persian world in particular, for some of you who've heard some of my podcasts, it's great to see so many Persians in there, Simon. But what I wanted to start off with really is to ask you, how on earth do you conceive of an idea of a history on this level?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Ali, this is so good to do this with you. A long-held ambition, so thank you. And Chalk, great to be here with you again. Thank you very much for coming tonight. Really, I love this place. So great to be back. This book is, of course, a work of complete madness. And it's an insane concept that I had. I wasn't sure I could do it. But the basic idea was like this. I always follow the dictum of one of my heroes, Benjamin Disraeli. Mm-hmm. And he always said, when I want to read a book and I can't find it, I write it myself. And I've always been a huge fan of world histories. They're filled with lists of commodities and trade routes and technological advances. But oftentimes, the humans that are involved in the story are a little distant, if not present at all often. Mm. And I also love biographies, and I know you're all great history readers. I've written a few myself. And biographies are an exercise in intimacy and detail. And so I wanted to find a way to combine the two, to combine the span of global history, which I'd always wanted to write, with the grit, the juice of individuals. Now, as you know, biographies, anyway, have been getting longer and longer. Yeah. And in America, they're absurd. I mean, you know, Robert Caro's biography of LBJ is now, I think it's in its 6,000-page volume. You know, Neil Ferguson's new biography of Kissinger is 1,000 pages before he's even met Nixon, you know, the second volume is about to come out. Andrew Roberts's Winston Churchill, which is a brilliant book, is exactly the same length as my world history. And I've got all the Churchills in
here. And more.
So I wanted to find a way to combine those two things. And I couldn't think of a way to do it. And my mother, who was then in her 90s, a typical Jewish mother, said to me, Simon, she said, you need your sleep. This is going to ruin your diet. Give the money back. And you don't need to write the book at all. And but sadly, she died just before COVID, before I ever wrote it. So she never saw that I actually managed to write it. But her advice was very good. I should have given the money back. But here we are. I wrote the book. And so I tried to think of a way to do certain things. I mean, one is, you mentioned this book, it has many flaws, but it is, I think, the most diverse world history ever written. And it's filled with places that we should know more about. Not just places like Russia and Ukraine, but also Iran, Afghanistan, Cambodia, lots of places that are hugely important in world history. China, that we don't always know about. Mm. So one part of it was diversity. Another part of it was female history, women. And of course, I wanted to find a way to write about women. Another thing I wanted to do was to avoid, we were just talking in the tent about the Iranian Revolution. Mm. And you were saying that you left as a very small boy, you left in 1979, Iran. Mm. And you were saying that that when you were living through the revolution, you were watching a James Bond film.
I did, I'm afraid, yes. I was. I mean, one of the things we were discussing is precisely this, is that, I mean, one of the beauties of the book in that sense is to look at look at history really unfolding from the ground up.
That's right.
And from the individual,
that's right,
isn't it? Getting away from these grand theories. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, well, what he was, the point of that story is that he was watching The Spy Who Loved Me in Farsi.
That's right.
And not realising that
in the original language, I should say.
Yeah, original language. Yeah. James Bond is much better in Farsi, Persian, by the way. Yeah. but he was watching James Bond, not realising the revolution was happening. And that's the point of this book. One of the points is to write history with in an immediate way so that you don't always know the Shah is going to fall. Yeah. You don't always know that Napoleon III is going to lose the Battle of Sedan, and so on. And without sort of teleology, and I'm trying to find a way to do all these things. Another thing I wanted to do was to show, which is related to this, is to avoid the feeling that you know where the next big thing is going to happen, which most histories kind of, you know, the next big thing is going to be the Iran Revolution, for example, and or the Ukrainian War, for example. And I wanted to catch that messiness of human affairs where lots of things are happening, and many politicians think this is going to be this is the burning issue, but in fact it's this one, which is happening simultaneously. So all these things I wanted to were percolating, and then I thought. And another thing I wanted to capture was, again, many history books are sort of empires fall, there's a battle, a religion is founded, another empire falls. I wanted to get the feeling of continuity. When I was in Jerusalem, I remember when I wrote about Jerusalem, I remember I looked at the stones of the thresholds of old buildings, and the stones are worn very low by thousands of years of footsteps. I wanted to catch that. And part of the way I wanted to catch that was through food, through clothes. And then, yes, family. Family does all of these things. It's a really simple idea. And I just agonized about, could it work? Could you do a world history through families? And I immediately went to my kitchen table and I got this huge sort of unrolled this great bit of paper. And I thought, what are the families of which I can base this book around?
So, I mean, how did you choose?
Well,
I mean, obviously, as long as it is, you obviously have to select key dynasties or families or others. So, what were the criteria?
There were no criteria at all.
Right.
the criteria seriously were, first of all, I like to write history that's light, but that also covers the serious themes and is academically correct. And I do something, I've given a name to it, two names actually. I use families to harness, as harnesses to tell about serious movements, ideologies, new religions. I call it also tethering, to tether great movements in history. So the Enlightenment, the Reformation, all of these things are in the book, of course. Marxism are in the book, the rise of Islam, but they're tethered to families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I write about Mozart, I tether him to the Habsburg family. I tell him through his main patron, Joseph II, for example. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I selected them. So first of all, they had to be hugely important somehow. And secondly, they had to interest me. Mm-hmm. And all my books are really written because they're the books that I'd like to read. And I'm my main reader, and because it's very hard to know what people want to read. And I've always, just since my first book, I've written the book that I would like to read, but for better or for worse.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, as you say, I mean, you've as much as you've had to select, it does cover an enormous amount of ground, and it does cover enormous geographic areas, and restores. I think, I mean, this is for me what's really interesting about it is that element of individual agency into sort of world-shattering events, but you can see how these individuals have had a role and how history is very contingent in this respect.
Yeah, and we see that in our own time.
Well,
I mean, whether it's with the last Shah or with Vladimir Putin or with Donald Trump, you realise that actually, you know, the old Marxist ideology of history where there's all great movements is not complete. Mm. You know, a monocausal history is not a right, correct history. And But you said, how did I choose the families? What I did was, to see if the idea would work, was I selected the three great mega families of history.
Right.
So you should all, I'm sure you're all wondering in your mind who the mega families are.
Yeah.
So in this book, the mega families that I laid out in this bit of paper are, firstly, in Europe, the Charlemagne, well, the Merovingians to Charlemagne, to the Hofstaufen, to the Habsburgs.
Habsburgs, yeah.
Which goes from about 500 to about 1918. So that was Europe done. And that was the family I was going to use as the spine for my coverage of Europe. And then Asia, the family of Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
Which you know a lot about.
Yeah.
He's a specialist in Genghis Khan, among many other things. But Genghis Khan connects up with the family of Tamerlane, and they go on to rule India, the Mughals. So they go from about 1000 AD to about 1922, when the last Genghisid family in Bukhara in Central Asia is overthrown. And then the third great family is, of course, the family of the Prophet. And one never thinks of him as a dynasty.
Yeah.
But, of course, it is a dynasty. And three massive dynasties, Umayyads, Abbasids, Fatimids. And then, of course, the Hashemites, who rule in Jordan today, King Abdullah II of Jordan, they go all the way back. They are a very ancient family that is genuinely descended from the Prophet. I know many people, including the supreme leader of Iran, claim to be descended from the Prophet. But actually, the Hashemites probably are descended from the Prophet.
I think they're more directly descended, yes that's right. Yeah.
And so those three, and you know, the Hashemites were kind of emirs of Mecca for 1,000 years, and then had more kingdoms than just about any other family. They were kings of Syria, of Iraq, of Jordan, of Jerusalem, of Hejaz, and of all the Arabs in succession for a very short time.
So, I mean, if we go back to the Chinggisid, let's go to the Mongols, because the Mongols are always quite a lot of fun in this respect, especially at a distance. So the Mongols are a good example of the way in which, you know, family kinship actually can provide a very powerful political force. I mean, they're forming the greatest of, you know, contiguous land empires in history through really kinship connections. I mean, essentially, it's not like you have a government. It's basically government through family. Yet at the same time showing, really, after several generations, the sheer fragility of that and volatility of that system. And again, I think, you know, the beauty of the book is really to highlight this, is to move us away from these great structures and systems and others that sort of give a false sense of order to the way in which history operates, and shows, you know, how volatile these things can be. I mean, it's a much, much more dynamic environment, isn't it, really?
Well, I mean, we see even today, when you look at many, many countries, virtually all countries today have presidencies, some sort of legislature, some sort of form of elections, whether fair or not. And yet, when you look at many of these countries, they are, in fact, for all intents and purposes, family monarchies, or monarchies for sure. And we see that even in our own time. So of course, you know, you go back in history, and I guess one of the questions the book poses is, you know, why is family rule, why is monarchy or dynasty the predominant form of government in human history, you know, throughout time? And one of the reasons is the human craving for stability.
That's right.
And predictability and comfort and reassurance in a world that is in fact terrifying, you know, from natural disasters and diseases. Mm. I mean, particularly in times when, you know, you didn't have science, so, you know, you had no clue why things were happening, and you needed explanations. And of course, all of those things come into play just as much today, in a way, as they did then, in different, not necessarily in Britain, but in other places in the world.
Because, I mean, you're quite right, of course, even in our sort of, when we're looking at our modern secular age and maybe in our democratic systems, you know, we still have we still have families. I mean, we still have dynastic families that can often play a very profound political influence, I think. And
I think
in the Americas, you know, the Kennedys, so on.
I feel bad leaving the Genghis Khan.
Okay,
well, we could come back.
We'll come back to
you. But what you say is right. I mean, what's fascinating is, you know, we live in a world where in places like Paris, London, New York, Washington, we pride ourselves on, we live in a secular society. Our democracies are sort of fair. There's no corruption. There are some connections, but they're ruthlessly exposed in the press, and so on. But actually, first of all, that's exceptional in the world. That only exists in a few democracies.
Yeah.
One of the points I make in the book, is that, you know, our ideas of democracy, which we are taught, are so long in coming to fruition. Are in fact so fragile and so recent. I mean, if you think that America has had a system of apartheid or slavery until 1965, when I was born, and so it's only been a real democracy, you know, for 50 something years. Mm. And you know, when I was growing up, you know, Spain and Portugal were dictatorships. Eastern Europe were dictatorships. You know, the world that we live in, which we prize, which we feel is permanent, which we feel is ancient, is much more recent than we think. But anyway, even if we look at our societies, first of all, they're much less secular than we think. There are many orthodoxies that people think. If people challenge climate change, for example, people are actually accused of being mad, just like people were accused of. People who didn't believe in Jesus Christ were accused of being insane in the Middle Ages. In all sorts of ways, there are saints and orthodoxies in our societies today. But more, this book is about families, and you know, the courts of modern leaders, whether it's Macron or Tony Blair or the Trump, you know, the Trump family or the Kennedys, our democracies are actually filled with families. One of the interesting things is that where there's a constitutional monarchy in Europe, there are no political family dynasties, which is weird.
That's
while in countries that, like America, which eschew any sort of touch of monarchy, in fact, the presidency is incredibly monarchical, and of course, they're filled. Their political life is filled with dynasties. You know, and you mentioned, you know, the Kennedys. I mean, Robert Kennedy Jr. now. Is awful in many ways. By the way, I just saw a picture of him showing his Kennedy machismo by doing press-ups topless. Have you seen that tweet? It's very alarming. Don't look if you don't need to. But the Kennedy, you know, he is now polling over 20% of Democratic voters. So though he's unlikely to displace Joe Biden, he could ruin his nomination. You know, he could ruin his coronation as Democratic candidate.
And that must be principally because of the familiarity with the Kennedy name.
So what you have, first of all, is like in our democracies, in great democracies like India, like America, you have these what I call demo dynasties, where families like the Bushes, the Roosevelts, the Kennedys, where people like these families. And by the way, you know, it's not just those famous families. If you look at American senators and governors, they're all descended, you know, a huge percentage of them are the children and grandchildren of governors and senators. And what you have there is, in a way, the best sort of family inheritance, which is that you can elect these people, but you can unelect them too. You can get rid of them as well. But you have the reassurance, the stability of families that you feel you know, and also that you feel may have experience in dealing with power and aren't going to lose their heads. But there are other countries where family power is, I mean, obviously in Britain and the northern European constitutional monarchies, you have a situation which I believe is idiosyncratic, but works, where you have part of the state stabilized by being personified in a family and an inheritance, which some people think is ridiculous, but I think works. And then you have the Middle East absolute monarchies have never been more powerful. You now have the US president going cap in hand to the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. You know, they've never been.
I mean, you also get a whole string of hereditary presidencies.
And you may get hereditary
presidential monarchies, or whatever they call them, where they're all pretending to be presidencies, whatever.
Well, I call those essential monarchies.
Essential monarchy. Yeah.
Where you've got. But this isn't just. I mean, obviously, in the Arab world, there's an enormous tendency. The Mubaraks, the Gaddafis, the Saddams didn't pull off the inheritance.
Assads.
But the Assads have pulled off the inheritance. You've got people like Museveni in Uganda. You've got the Kims in North Korea. You know, there are a lot of these, exactly as you say, there are a lot of these states that have, they all have presidencies, they all have legislatures, they all have some sort of elections, but actually they are hereditary monarchies. And so that's the world today. So you are having a sort of dynastic resurgence that is interesting and is happening in much of the world. I mean, look at Pakistan, for example. In India, you have the 60 years of Indian democracy, but the rule of one family, the Nehruvian family. Look at Pakistan today. I mean, it may be very fragile, but you have a government that is run by Prime Minister Sharif, Foreign Minister Bhutto Zardari. You know, two dynasties. It's the government of dynasties. You look at Bangladesh. You know, Sheikh Hasina is the daughter of the founder of Bangladesh. And I could go on and on. But the point is that there's a reason this is happening. And by the way, there are surprising examples. You know, like, look at Afghanistan. Look at the government in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. You know, the Haqqani dynasty, the Haqqani terrorist connection, which you may remember from Homeland, the series always being mentioned in Homeland, is a real thing. And there are more than four members of the Afghan government that are part of the Haqqani family. And that is a terrorist family that were in command of the military, in command of the Taliban military, and commanded the retaking of Afghanistan. So all over the place this is happening. And why is it happening? And I think it's happening because these states, often set up by colonial powers in after World War II at some point, have failed in some way to connect, Western institutions with providing safety, comfort, security for people. And people have returned to families, to clans, to connections to provide justice and security. And that's the way it's always
been. The individual is something you can relate to. I mean, that's probably, and that's how the constitutional monarchies, obviously, that's how they sell them. So I wanted to take you to one of those areas where, of course, you're an expert on and very familiar with, and is Russia, which is very much in the news. I was going to say, what the hell is Putin up to? But I'll leave that. But in terms of dynasties, we always hear with Putin that he's very keen. I mean, everyone I talk to who knows anything about Russia, they say, Putin's massively keen on the Tsars. He thinks that, the great tragedy was the collapse of Tsarist Russia, and that he's very keen, on restoring that in some ways. But, is he? Or, what is he up to? I mean, he clearly has no dynastic possibilities himself, does he?
Well, so what is he up to? He only has daughters anyway.
Exactly. But, and don't they live abroad or something?
They probably live around here.
I know.
They probably have vast estates around here. I think the fascinating thing about Putin is, yes, he has channeled in his 23 years in power what he thinks are the most successful rulers of Russia. And he's keen to emulate those rulers. And they always have been the successful czars, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Nicholas the First, and Stalin. Because, whatever we think of Stalin, everything he did was at a cost that is completely unacceptable. But he was the most successful Russian ruler of the 20th century by far, without anyone coming close. He found Russia in chaos. He left it a superpower and an industrial power. I mean, one thing about Stalin, I think, what I talk about in the book, which is that, He did extraordinary things. He killed an enormous number of people. He believed in changing society by killing, and he was open about it. There are conversations he had with some British trade unionists. He said, you know, you may follow it in your country when you create socialism in England. He said, you know, you may do things, you know, more quietly and in an English way. He said, but we did it by just shedding blood. And he said this to many other people. So he was very frank about, like, very similar to Mao. He was very open about it. But, you know, during the war, they did amazing things in the war, which were extraordinary, which no one will ever be able to do again, or before or after, because he was more powerful than any czar had ever been and any president of Russia has ever been. But, you know, they were able to move entire cities behind the lines to create Tankergrad, for example. And they were able to outproduce German tanks by 3-1, you know, within 3 years of the war. And there's a great recording, which I don't know if you know about, which I've talked about in the book, because it's one of the great unlistened to unheard treasures of World War II, where Hitler is talking to Marshal Mannerheim, the commander of Finland, and he talks about how it's just astonishing. It's like, he says, it's just like a miracle. It's like a ghost. It's like a sort of ghost nightmare. That we invaded this country, Russia, and then we found out that they had 40,000 tanks or something. They were able to produce. And he said, I just, when generals told me this, I thought it was a lie. I didn't believe it. And it's turned out to be true. And so Stalin was extraordinary, utterly terrifying and monstrous too. But the point is that Putin aspires to be like these people, and he repeatedly asked people he met when the rare times he met intellectuals, he would say to them, "How is history going to remember me?" And they would always say stuff like, "Oh well, you know, the education is much improved in Russia," and of course he said, "Is that all? Is that all?" And that brings us to where we are today. He is obsessed with history. And, you know, you mentioned 1917 just now. I mean, the bizarre thing about his speech at the weekend...
That's right. He mentioned
1917. Extraordinarily stupid thing to mention. Because, you know, he always said... He's repeatedly said to many people, you know, I despise Gorbachev and Nicholas II. Mm. You know, they are the people that gave away the empire, that abdicated, that gave up. I will never be that person. I'd never give up. I'd never abdicate. And yet this parallel, and this just shows when your ruling base, your inner circle becomes very narrow. And so no one said to him, like, you know, Mr. President, I wouldn't mention 1917 because people could think that, you know, people could identify you with Nicholas II because no one can say, if it was Downing Street, there'd be some cocky young 20-year-old who would say that to the Prime Minister. But that never happens in an autocracy, because as the Shah found out, you hear less and less truth the longer you go on. The less you want to hear the truth, the less you can hear the truth, the less people tell you the truth, and the less people are left who are still there to tell you the truth as well, because people retire, people die, and of course, you get fed up with those old associates that know you well enough to tell you stuff. And so you get rid of them, and then you never hear
then
again.
Then you just want people to tell you what you want to hear.
And so that's what's happened. So no one said to him, like, don't mention 1917. It's going to come out all wrong. But the question is a very good question. When I wrote my first book, Catherine the Great and Potemkin, which has now become weirdly relevant 20 years after I wrote it, because Catherine the Great and Potemkin, apart from being one of those amazing partnerships of a man and a woman, really the greatest partnership of a man and woman in all of world history, and for which we have all the love letters, which is of their sex life, of their political life, which is amazing. But of course, they conquered and annexed Crimea and Ukraine, and they founded all the cities that are now so important: Sebastopol, Odessa, Mariupol, Kherson, all these cities that they're fighting for now. And when I wrote that book, no one had really studied Catherine the Great and Potemkin in Russia for 70 years because it was very out of fashion under Stalin. And so when I wrote it, weirdly, I was approached by the Kremlin, and I was approached by people from the presidential entourage, and they said, could you meet me? So I was fascinated to meet, because, you know, there was this new, credibly enlightened, young reformer in the Kremlin, who we all had great hopes for. His name was Vladimir Putin.
Oh.
And so, you know, he was apparently interested in looking for an enlightened
basis. So you met
basis.
Him?
I never met him.
Oh, right. I thought we were going to interesting territory there for me.
That would have been...
Yeah,
but so he read the book, and they asked me, they actually said, could you write a one-pager about how you know, Potemkin and Catherine took the Crimea and Ukraine? And this was in 2000. So that was a very interesting moment. Of course, at the time, I thought little of it.
But isn't Potemkin also famous for his villages?
But the villages are a huge sort of libel, really.
Oh,
I mean, the Potemkin villages are a Potemkin village of history. Because Potemkin villages, of course, are the name for a falsified town where you only have the stage set of a town, but actually there's nothing behind it. And of course, and that has a special resonance for dictatorships like Russia, like China, which are experts at creating Potemkin villages. But Potemkin himself actually built these cities. But it was of course the English press that created the idea of a Potemkin village, even in the 1790s. Nothing's changed in that way. But the thing is that so Putin said to me, you know, his people said to me, you know, that we love the fact that you've written this book about Catherine and Potemkin. President Putin has a reward for you. Which is always a terrifying moment when it comes to President Putin.
Not a cup of tea, I hope.
Not a cup of tea. No. It wasn't a Novichok. It wasn't a bit of Novichok. They said to me, we're opening Stalin's archive. Would you like to be the first person works in Stalin's archive? So that was a pretty nice prize. But when I published the book, when I went to the archive, by the way, Russian archives are a very weird place, by the way. First of all, everyone's intermarried. Everyone's related to everybody else. And they all live underground. So it's very weird, sort of intermarried, kind of like a tiny... There's a family.
There's a family for you.
A very sort of weird family. But so when I was in the archive, I had my own private room. They brought me all Stalin's documents. And there were amazing documents they brought me. Like they brought me the documents about a file. It said Svetlana Stalin. It was about Stalin's daughter. And it was all about how Stalin, the letters, when I opened, I couldn't believe it. Stalin's daughter, Svetlana, aged about 10, liked to pretend that she was the dictator of Russia. So she would write, I, Svetlana Stalin, aged 9, do hereby order that all homework in the Soviet Union be abolished for a year. And actually said this. And she signed it, Svetlana Stalin, a first secretary of the Communist Party, member of the Politburo. And underneath, to my amazement, was Stalin signed it. Stalin signed it, your obedient serf, Stalin. And it was signed by Molotov, by Beria, by everybody.
Oh my God, really?
And they stuck it on their fridge. They stuck it on their General Electric fridge in their apartment with a magnet. Just like our fridges, right? And anyway, so they had that sort of stuff. But when I published the book, Stalin, The Call of the Red Tsar, Putin hated it. And he thought I'd betrayed everything, my opportunities. And so I lost all my privileges. And so when I went back to write Young Stalin, I said, can I have my old room back? They said, we don't know you. Yeah. You never had a room here. So anyway, but the interesting thing about Putin is, yes, I mean, he's fascinated with the Tsars. He's fascinated with empire. He's read too much history. Yes, you can have too much history. And that's a very dangerous thing. I think it was also dangerous with Shah.
Well, it's dangerous with a lot of autocrats.
Beware despotic history buffs.
Because they become increasingly paranoid, of course. I mean, that's the problem. Now, I wanted to pivot to a slightly different angle on the book, which I found quite interesting. We were discussing this earlier. And before we do go to questions, which we will get to questions in a minute, was that you actually have a music list, a Spotify list attached to the book, which I'm fascinated about, and I want to know what these musical pieces are that you have well, connected with the... What is it?
There are some Persian songs.
Are there?
The Barai.
Very good.
The song of the Iranian Revolution is in there for you.
Thank you.
But the idea was... it is a fun idea. The idea was... What happened was, when I was writing the book, I tried to get into the mood.
Yeah.
By... I put on the music. So when I was writing about Soviet Union and World War II, I put on Katusha. When I was writing about Germany, I played Lili Marlene. When I was talking about...
What were you doing Genghis Khan? What did you do?
I didn't have a Genghis Khan, but I had Rasputin for Nicholas II.
Oh, you did?
By Boney M, of course. Boney M, by the way, are one of the most respected analysts of late Imperial Russia. But seriously, I started to listen to the music. But as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, one of the ideas of this book was to have, you know, the things that you don't always have in history books, especially not world history books, to have the sort of feeling of life and continuity going on. So, you know, literature, poetry, music, sex. Mm-hmm. And music is very important. It's part of life. And every era, every person has their own song.
But did you have music for the earlier, you know, to characterize the earlier periods as well?
It was harder to do the Achaemenid dynasty.
Oh, no, I was wondering what you might have used.
Or the Safavids. I didn't, but, you know, but once you got... The great thing is, I mean, the great thing about our era is, like, after the 1920s, there's music for everything.
That's right, yeah.
And we have recorded music. And so I started to create... a playlist, and then I thought, like, actually, what about having a playlist, a soundtrack for a history book? And so I started to make, and it's on Spotify, and it's called A Soundtrack to the World History. It's under my name, do have a look. And, I mean, partly it's because, you know, one of the fascinating things that's happened in modern times is that music has merged with the great movements of world history, you know, capitalism, commercialism, popular culture, you know, has happened. So, for example, you know, there's a huge character in the book is Elvis Presley. I was just on an American tour I went to 11 cities in America, an insane journey. But I went to Graceland, and I went on pilgrimage. And Elvis is one of those characters, one of those people like Elton John, like Bowie, like Ella Fitzgerald, like Sinatra, who are at that place where, like the Stones, like the Beatles, where there's a sort of like a Venn diagram where power, capitalism, culture meet. And, you know, take someone like Sinatra. You know, after the war, he was really the inventor, you could say, of the kind of, with the Bobby Soxers, of popular culture, where people, teenagers, started to buy millions of records. Then in 1946, he played in Havana for Lucky Luciano, Bugsy Siegel, and Meyer Lansky with the great mafia summit meeting in Havana, which was then a sort of decadent gambling headquarters for Americans. Then he went on to become great friends with the Kennedys. He introduced the Kennedys to Marilyn Monroe. He introduced... That went well, didn't it? then he introduced the Kennedys to Judith Exner, who was the paramour of Sam Giancana, the head of the Chicago Mafia.
These are more families, of course.
Yeah, more families. And mafia families are sort of parodies of real families, and of course they're in the book for that reason. So we've got all those early mafia fans, Lucky Luciano and Vito Genovese and all these people. And then of course he went on to be the advisor to Ronald Reagan and to organize the inauguration. So there's a classic character whose music is not only the music of an era, but who crossed with power, with culture, with capitalism. And there was a time, you know, there was a 50-year period between about 1950 and, say, 2000, when the internet started and media diffused in a way that was became almost impossible to pin down. But there was a 50-year period when these huge rock stars, one could call them, like Elvis, like the Stones, like Elton, like Bowie, were sort of at the top of the social, you know, they were the top of the social apex of society in a way that had never happened before. They came from working class backgrounds, many of them. And they could command, wherever they went, they commanded stadiums of, you know, 150,000 people, 80,000 people. So it was a unique period. You know, other important things were happening. But that was an important...
There was a festival, I think, yesterday where Elton John was playing.
Yeah. And he's still playing. And he's in the book.
He's in the book. But of course, they do define ages. I mean, obviously, as you say in the book, there are many of these
and
modern
musicians.
And
it's over. It's not going to happen. That, you know, it's not going to happen again. It's much more. You know, culture is very diffused now. Mm. So they are unique figures. They're not going to be replaced, but they are rather like sort of the nephews of popes or grand dukes from you know earlier eras, and they'll never be replaced. And they were self-made people. So they're interesting sociologically. But anyway, I made this list, and.
How long is it?
It's 40 hours now.
40 hours?
Yeah. But it's got... I do listen to
it's
it because...
It's almost got, as long as...
It's got music from India and Iran and Africa and the Arab world. It's got the songs that Gamal Abdel Nasser played to accompany his revolution in Egypt. And the number one, which you may all disagree with, is Sympathy for the Devil.
I was going to ask you about that, yes.
Which I think... Are you dubious about that as number one?
No. Well, I'm not. I'm just curious about it. I do like the song. I think as you do. But I was wondering why it's number one.
I'll tell you why it's number one. It's got a novelistic narrative persona. So if you remember it, please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I think it's very influenced by Bulgakov, and Mick Jagger had obviously just read Master and Margarita. So it's narrated by the devil, and you don't know it's the devil in the song until you go along. And then it narrates all the great monstrosities of 20th century history, which, of course, are all in the book. Mm. You know, I drove a tank, held a general's rank when the blitzkrieg raged and the bodies stank. I'll tell you who killed the Kennedys. Mm. They killed the Tsar and all his ministers. So all these things are in that. So it is a sort of masterpiece. Not only is it a great song, but it's also a great history song, and it's got a narrative, it's got a novelistic trope of a mysterious narrator who you gradually is unveiled. So it's very clever, actually, and it's interesting. So it's number one for its cleverness.
No, I can see how that works for the
and because it's got so many events that are in the book. But you know, you may argue for a Joan Baez or Barry or. You know, many of the songs. But it's got songs that I think are either talk about history a lot or are songs that accompanied great historical events like the Iranian Revolution.
Yeah,
so that's why. So I do look at it, and if you disapprove, please write to me and complain and propose a better song to be number one.
So I think we now have some time questions, if that's... do we have some microphones? We do have microphones that are roaming... And I see a gentleman on the right there with a hand up.
Thank you to both of you for that. You mentioned quite early on the verbose preamble to a biography of Kissinger, and you also mentioned the brutality of Stalin, but how explicit he was about blood. And those of us from Africa and many others from South America and the Far East would regard Kissinger as the kind of Stalin of the other side, but because he's part of our side, he gets away with, he turned 100 last month, his September the 11th is coming up, the anniversary of that. He seems to have got away with a lot of blood and death, but explicitly. And how do you treat Kissinger in this book, and how do you treat him generally in history?
I think it's a very good question. I mean, personally, I think Kissinger is only a war criminal if virtually all the presidents and secretaries of state since the war are war criminals. You may argue that they all are. Actually, the Kissinger's become one of those lightning rods for American cynicism, great power cynicism in the 70s. I personally, as I said, regard him just as actually pretty typical of the American executive post 1945, when it was really a military presidency that believed in enforcing, in one, defeating Soviet advances, and two, trying to enforce their vision of a liberal society by war across the world. Some people regard that as a great crime. I personally take a more generous view of that because I believe that our systems are superior, our democracies, including American democracy, which is a system that I hugely admire, I think is one of the greatest, best influences on world affairs and is hugely superior to Soviet dictatorship, for example. Doesn't mean that they've got everything right. And as for Kissinger, I'm lucky that I've known Kissinger. And I asked him, even though he was 99 at the time, I asked him to read the sections on between 1969 and 77, 76, when he was in power. That doesn't mean I allowed him to censor my views on Cambodia or anything else, actually. But he did write back. Amazingly, at 99, he wrote back and said, I'd be delighted to read these things just for factual accuracy. And so I got back an amazing document, which was Henry Kissinger's notes on that period and whether I'd got things right or not. And I was under no obligation to accept his view, by the way. And it didn't change my view in any way. But it was rather like getting Metternich's notes on the Napoleonic Wars or Kaunitz's notes on the Seven Years' War. So it was a rather amazing thing. And one of the fun things in this book, with bringing the history right up to the present time, is that the book ends on the day of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And one of the fun things about this is I've put in my own experiences in the fall of the Soviet Union. And by the way, there's no greater training for a historian, especially a world historian, than to see a great empire fall with your own eyes. And I was very lucky to see that in the early 90s. But I've also put in a lot of the people that I've spoken to. I've been lucky enough to know, not just Kissinger, but, Shevardnadze and Shimon Peres and others, Margaret Thatcher, who I knew. And I don't know, I think it adds a certain immediacy. And I was very lucky that I've seen some of these great events. Mm. I was there when Yeltsin attacked the White House in 93 in Moscow and so on. So anyway, some of these characters are in the book.
So there was a lady
there. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you very much. It's Seth Robertson. Just a question for you, Simon. Thank you very much for a great talk, by the way, guys. I listened to your Audible book, and I loved the way you culturally connected the narrators with the chapter. I was wondering if that was your vision and if you had a part in choosing who read which chapter.
Yes, I did. It was my vision. I wanted to have, because this is a very international, global book, and because there are sections on West Africa and China and so on, I wanted to have, different voices do the audio. So if you listen to the audio, it's got about 20 readers. I read the introduction and the conclusion. The rest of it is read by people from those parts of the world. And I like it because you hear it in voices from other places. So yeah, it was my idea. And I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you.
So this gentleman, and then I'll come to you in a minute.
Simon, thank you for the talk. In writing a book of such breadth, there must be areas sometimes that are easier than others. Could you perhaps tell us which of the family chapters you most enjoyed writing and which you found most difficult and why?
That's a very good question. I mean, the most difficult by far is China. Chinese society, Chinese culture, Chinese history is so different from anything that we know, that it requires a massive leap of knowledge. I should say all history, especially writing a world history like this, takes, I think essential to writing all history is humility and realizing how little we know about other societies, other worlds, about the past. And of course, we know in our own lives, sometimes we find out that people we live with, we don't know as well as we thought we should. And so one has to project that back. But what you're touching on is a very interesting point, which is, you know, there are some subjects in this that I know very well, like Russia, like Ukraine, like Georgia, where I've spent a lot of time. There are other places like Iran, like China, where I didn't know enough, I didn't know much, and I tried to listen to the experts. So what I did was, people say to me, like, did you write this with millions of researchers? And I didn't. I didn't really have any researchers. I started off with two wonderful researchers, but they got pregnant, as researchers sometimes do. And so I decided to go on without any researchers. Instead, what I decided to do was to write in each section, whether it was China or Iran or West Africa, I decided to write to the world expert on that subject, a world expert. So I would write to the expert at Harvard University of the Tang Dynasty in China, for example. And some of them wrote back and said, get lost. Some of them wrote back and said, this book is so appalling that I in no way can have my name on it. But, here's what you should say, these chapters. They were my favorite, by the way. Another one said, I love my name to be on it, and you can use my, you can mention me, and here are my notes. But the point is, humility. I just sat at the feet of people, the great experts. I was very lucky that because sometimes they'd read my books, they were happy to help me. And I took all the help I could get. And as for my favorite pages, if you want to, you can read this book in many different ways. You can read it, you can start at the end, you can start at the beginning, you can start in the middle. But if you want to start somewhere the most fun, it's my favorite chapters. And those are the chapters that cover Harun al-Rashid and the Abbasid Caliphate in Baghdad in the sort of 8th, 9th centuries, and which is the age of the 1001 Nights, the stories that you will know about from your childhood. And you will be astonished at the sauciness, the decadence, the wit, the poetry, the fun of that Arab Muslim society at its height. And you will be astonished that this is a Muslim society and delighted by the outrageous poetry.
Lots of drinking as well.
A lot of drinking, a lot of sex, a lot of wit, a lot of poetry, a lot of bisexuality, a lot of fluidity.
Mm-hmm.
It's all happening. Start there.
I'm afraid I'm just going to have to take three final questions. So there's one here.
Simon, I'd be very interested to hear whether you find that rulers tend to go off the boil after 10 or 15 years and indeed start boiling their citizens. Is the two-year limitation on US presidents, for example, do you think that history suggests that's the right thing to do?
Yeah, very nice question. Thank you. I mean, I think all rulers go mad after 10 years. And I think you only have to look at even, Margaret Thatcher and others.
It's a good figure,
to see that even in democracies, they're all barking mad after 10 years and they should be retired. I think that probably that is correct. You know, the two-term Roosevelt convention where they, there's only two terms in American, of course, two consecutive terms.
Mm.
Yeah.
Gentleman here.
Hello, Seabag. It's Boo Heights Jackson. Thanks for a very entertaining chat. You talk a lot about families in America and Europe and Asia. And I'm just wondering, you only mentioned one in Uganda. Is there an issue around Africa in your book, and I have to confess, I haven't read your book, and I'm going to rush out and buy it now.
Good stuff.
But is Africa just such a huge continent with so many examples you can't fit them in the book? Or is there something special about Africa that you can mention and talk about now?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's more about Africa in this book than in any world history so far. And it's filled with African history, in fact. One of the things I decided when I wrote this book was to treat all families the same. And so I treat the royal families of Dahomey or Benin or Congo or the Gaza Empire, which is in Mozambique, or the Muhammad Ali dynasty in Egypt, and so on. I treat them all exactly as I treat the Habsburgs or the Kennedys. And so the book is absolutely filled with Africa. Mm. And I think you'll find more Africa in this than you can handle. So I'm very proud of that, because actually even the most progressive historians, for some reason, always start their African section. A lot of them start their African sections when some Brit or Spaniard turns up with a galleon full of cannons. But in fact, all of them start much earlier here. Yeah. But that doesn't just apply to Africa. I mean, I think what's fun about this is the family idea works very well in this way. The Benin family, for example, you'll know the family that ruled Benin a century before any Portuguese turned up in West Africa. And similarly, with the Incas or the family, the ruling family of the Mexica and the Aztecs, you know the dynasty, the founding of the dynasty 200 years before Cortes or Pizarro turn up. And that applies throughout Africa. And Africa's covered, right from the beginning of humanity, right up to Museveni, Idi Amin, Mandela, Haile Selassie. Ethiopia is hugely important in this book, of course. So there's a lot of Africa. And, one of the interesting things is, we wanted to avoid presentism in this book. I know we're running out of time.
We
wanted to avoid presentism in this book. But some things in the present are pretty useful. And we're all fascinated with slavery now. Well, this book doesn't just have Atlantic slavery, which is hugely important, but very widely covered now. But you'll also find out about East African slavery, the slave trade in Trans-Saharan slave trade, and also that in the Black Sea and Ukraine. And so I hope you find a lot of Africa in here anyway. So thank you so much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I do apologise, but I'm afraid the chair has now decided that we've got to end this marvellous session. I know Simon will be around, I think, a little bit to answer.
I can sign books.
Sign, certainly sign
any books.
And
sign.
Any other questions you may have. Thank you so much for being such a wonderful audience. And enjoy dinner.
Thank you.